I actually found the prospect of preaching on this this reading quite humbling. It's a vast theological, personal, emotional mass of fact and challenge. But I don't know how many of you are familiar with a chap called Frank Muir. He was a sort of Billy Connolly for the sort of sherry drinking classes. But he once told this story about driving in Devon around the corner came this Volvo with this very horsey woman driving it. And she leaned out and shouted, "Pig!" And he thought, crumbs, that was a bit uncalled for, you know, not done anything to her. And he turned the corner and he hit a pig. So it was obvious she was actually trying to warn him that this thing was round the corner. Now, the significance of someone's words may not actually become apparent until we've turned a particular corner, at which point we hit the pig. And I actually found that true of Scripture very often, but today I found that true of this passage in particular. I mean, the passage this morning is fabulously rich, and it's got sort of multiple entry points in terms of themes or emphases. But the one that I actually felt compelled to adopt this morning is from verse 11. Let me just grab this one.
Why did Jesus actually
why did Jesus present his disciples with the facts and challenges in this passage when he did? Now, verse 11 is a sort of thread along which the other verses and truths can be strung a bit like pearls. Now, there's some theology light for you. But this thread is right off of verse 11. That my joy may be in you and your joy may be complete. Now, if we take a step back and look at this whole message as in its completeness, this is quite an unexpected exhortation from Jesus at the time he gave it. It's quite unexpected for it to come from him at this particular juncture. Because Jesus could hardly be expected to be joyous at this particular point in anticipation of what was about to happen to him. And the disciples were about to confront the darkest 72 hours ever faced by any Christians. So surely an exaltation to joy would have been more appropriate at one of their post-resurrection encounters. Why did Jesus say that his joy could be in us and that our joy may be complete was the whole reasoning behind giving this statement, these words to the disciples at this point. Now, I'm going to make some observations, and then I'll try and draw some strands together. If Graham could put... So the first observation, we only learnt to do this morning, so... Have we got the first observation number one, hopefully? Okay. The first observation is from verses 1 and 5. We're organically, bodily, united with Christ. The power to bear fruit, whatever that may mean, comes through this organic union that we have with Jesus. We don't sort of strain upwards to reach God or undergo some sort of rigorous discipline or seek after special experiences or gain special knowledge. Jesus is present within us and within all his children, feeding us, if you like, from the bottom up, like a vine in soil. Now, there are some interesting insights into the use of the vine analogy, and actually also of the relationship of this picture of the vine to the Last Supper. But I want to leave those on one side. Perhaps we can pick them up on a Sunday evening if people are really interested. The critical point I want to take just from this particular picture is that our organic living union with Christ, affirmed by the indwelling of his Holy Spirit, is explained to us so that Jesus' joy may be in us and that our joy may be complete. Well done, Graham. Could we have the next observation? The second is that we will bear fruit. Jesus gives commands in this passage. We have several situations where Jesus actually tells us what to do. But interestingly enough, to bear fruit isn't one of his commands. God himself takes the responsibility for our productivity. It would be like me trying to command my children to grow. I can force them, fat chance, to eat greens and drink milk, but their height is totally outside my control, and I add that emphatically if you've ever seen my children. Their height is really not my responsibility. We're told that bearing fruit is to God's glory. And this must be the case because we can't actually do it alone. Someone looks at a Christian and says, God did that. That's to God's glory. I may have mentioned this before, but there was a story about this guy in Glasgow who was a heavy drinker and quite violent, and he became a Christian, and he was actually... He was ridiculed by a lot of his old friends. And one of them said, oh, well, actually, it's quite useful having you around because, you know, now you're around, you can turn, you know, water into wine. That would be really helpful. And he turned around and said, no, but, you know, I won't do that. But if you ask my wife, she'll tell you that I've turned wine into furniture. And another situation in my school, I remember... The RE teacher, who was head of the Christian Union, somebody became a Christian who'd been very much not a Christian. And he said, you know, the teachers have said to me, there's something different about Palumbo. You know, he's not the same person as he was 6 weeks ago. And the RE teacher said, that is more powerful than any number of reasoned discussions I can have with them about the existence of God. So our bearing fruit in that way is to God's glory because people see it and they have to give the acknowledgement of the change to the power of God working in somebody's life. So the next observation, if you don't mind, Graham. The form of the fruit we bear isn't described. Now, I think this demonstrates Jesus' anticipation of his involvement in our development. Now, obviously, he didn't expect us to start growing grapes or tomatoes on the ends of our fingers, but he didn't actually make explicit what the fruit was going to be. Now, we don't know what God has in store for us as individuals. But keeping commandments are actually evidence of the strength of a relationship, not an end in themselves. Bearing fruit, as is described in this passage, is a lot more significant and a lot more profound than just obeying and being seen to obey. We have the next observation. It's clear from what Jesus says that God not only instigated our relationship with him, but that he chooses to have that relationship conducted in terms of intimacy, love, and friendship. Now, that's where I'm going to leave predestination this morning. The fact that we're chosen is a cause for joy. Again, it's a very deep and in some respects controversial subject. I'm happy to pick it up again on another occasion, but what I want to look at this morning is the fact that the fact of our predestination, the fact that God selected us, is evidenced by Jesus telling us that the Father has revealed to him everything that he needs to know, and that Jesus has actually then made that known to us. We're selected, we're chosen, and then information is imparted to us. And then another aspect of this is that the Father has empowered us in prayer. We're specifically told in this passage that we should ask for things and they'll be given to us. So we have privilege and we have responsibility. The privilege comes in knowing that we are chosen and having the facility for asking anything in prayer and it being granted to us. And the responsibility comes in the requirement to keep God's commandments. And when looking at the commandments Jesus homes in on, it's particularly to attempt to demonstrate selfless love, which exemplifies and shows Jesus' commandment to us. And the final one of the observations is the indwelling. Jesus speaks of our indwelling and remaining with him. And the indwelling of Jesus is a relationship involving choice. It involves emotion and it involves response. We can't rationalize or think our way into a relationship with Jesus. I think some of us need to ask sometimes, what do we really want or expect from reading the Bible or seeking God? Do we just want our questions answered? Well, that's not what it's about. It's about experiencing an overwhelming love and responding to that love by giving our own hearts. Yes, Jesus does talk about obeying his commands. But obeyment of commands is evidence of our love for Jesus. Love for Jesus precedes the challenge that's given to keep his commandments. So we can move on to the next. So if we can move on to pulling the strands together. Sorry. So I didn't know we had this toy until I came in this morning, and so Graham and I have been putting this together in the course of the last few hymns. but in pulling the strands together, we must remember that what we're given here in John 15 are God's words, and these words set out the fundamentals for our engagement in a relationship with him. God is communicating to us in a very intimate setting how to enter into the relationship with him and how it's going to work. He gives us assurances to his commitment to us, and that assurance of his commitment is made even more compelling by what Jesus goes through in the next 24 hours on our behalf. That's evidence of the deepness and the level of his commitment to each one of us. So if we pull together our observations, the first is, our focus is verse 11. It's his joy in us, our joy being complete. We can be joyful and our joy can be complete in the bleakest of circumstances. This is our situation, that our joy can be complete in the bleakest of circumstances, when we have assurance around all that's described in this passage in John 15. First of all, our access and acceptability to God because of the work that Jesus has done in the person of the work that God has done in the person of Jesus. We're told that we're clean because of the words that Jesus tells us. If we accept the relationship with Jesus on the basis on which he's described it, we have no anxiety or fear about our acceptability to God. Secondly, our vital connection to Jesus, we've already looked at. Thirdly, in verse 8, the evidence of God's manifestation of himself in our lives. We bear much fruit. We show that we're his disciples. And we're also told about God's companionship with us, his responsibility for us, and his nurturing as the vine dresser. In that relationship, we have complete assurance that our darkest nights are within God's broader purpose and under his control. We're told in Hebrews that the author of our salvation was made perfect through suffering. And as we come to glorify God through our spiritual progress, the fruit, we'll inevitably suffer in this fallen world in which we actually inhabit mortal, short-lived, perishable bodies. Jesus knew that shortly after this upper room discussion, he would be explaining to John that he, Jesus, is the one who died and is alive forever. He was the one who holds the keys of death and hell. And this level of assurance can also underpin our confidence and our joy in Jesus. And our next concluding remark, or strand, is that God's desire in his final intimate communication before going to the cross is that we should have his joy and that our joy should be complete or full. Now, if you read verse 11 according to verse 11, the whole meaning and purpose of the mission of Jesus is to bring joy. Now, the Logos, if we look in verse 3, you are already clean because of the word, the Logos, I have spoken to you. That's the Logos there, God's purpose and truth. They're made real to us. We see that in verse 3. If God's purpose and truth are made real to us, we're clean. And then in verse 7, God's commandments, if you remain in me and my words remain in you, God's commandments which then direct and help us move along in the relationship as he'd have us live, his words live in us, his commandments guide our lives. Then, so we're clean, God's commandments guide our lives, we then evidence more of God's reality in our everyday experiences. We've been discussing some evenings during the week signs and wonders type experiences and words of knowledge and healing. Well, words of knowledge and other personal manifestations of the fulfillment of God's purposes in us happen as we're clean and as we conduct the relationship with God as he tells us we should do. We then become intimately bound up in these purposes of God, but we also have, as a consequence of that, that underlying, underpinning joy in the knowledge and the assurance of all that God gives us. Now, I can beat myself up hearing something like this because not only do I feel a spiritual failure very often, but I'm often joyless as well. So somebody telling me I should be joyful just adds to the burden that's already on top of me because I'm not doing very well spiritually. And if anything, lack of spiritual progress can douse and drown the few sparks of joy that faith may attempt to ignite. In these circumstances, the dialogue in John 15 is the place we need to be brought back to that intimate communication with Jesus in a room where refreshing and reassurance on all these issues can take place, so that we can have our faith and our confidence restored. Joy is normative for God's community. We can't expect to enter into an eternity with Jesus unless this joy is in our hearts. There's no room for grumpy old Christians. Now, people's experience of joy can be for any number of reasons, both the flippant and the profound. But to be truly joyful, the trigger which ignites the joy has to be real to you. And Jesus calls us to a solid, lasting experience. Jesus calls us to a platform of anticipation for the great things to follow. And these great things are made real to us through the closeness of Jesus in our everyday lives. You wouldn't expect Paul to be the rip-roaring party-goer, life and soul of the party type. But when you read his letters, it's clear his anticipation of what was coming his way through his relationship with Christ into eternity was a great driver and a great source of power to him. It seeps through every single epistle of the Apostle Paul. You read that stuff and you see that set your hearts wholly and unchangeably on the glory that's coming to you, our rich inheritance in the saints. This vision was clearly pushing him through all the difficulties, all the hardships that he faced for Jesus, for the church. It actually made these hardships and difficulties a joy to him. He could talk about joy in salvation because of the intimacy and closeness and the reality of these facts in his everyday life. And I've actually left the most difficult for last. Jesus makes an astonishing promise in this passage. Ask anything in my name and my Father will give it. Now, Jesus gives to us, as explained in this chapter, all these things are told to us, that Jesus' joy may be in us and our joy may be complete. So we can ask, we can bring things before God, but God's joy for us may actually lie in a different direction. God's joy for us may lie in a different solution, a different timing, a different outcome. Jesus doesn't say in this chapter, ask anything in my name and the total lack of response will leave you flat and totally joyless. But actually, that's sometimes how it can feel. We have to abandon our presumptuousness and anxiety as to the outcome of our prayers and seek the joy of God's presence through the situation. It's God's priorities and love in a situation that must come real to us. In those circumstances, we will sow in tears. It's the joy of the Lord which is our strength. It's not having God confirm our understanding or ambition by giving the results we ask for. You see, solid joys and lasting treasures lay in the dialogue and the fellowship of that upper room. So where does that leave us this morning? Well, verse 11 clearly tells us Jesus' joy should be in us. That's a holy, sanctified, God-given joy. And our joy should be full. That might sound flippant. That might sound easy in the circumstances that any one of us are facing. You may sit there thinking, well, who the hell are you to say that? You've not got the burden I'm carrying. you're not facing the situation I'm facing. It's not me that's saying this. I'm reading straight off the words of Jesus. And Jesus said these words in front of some hours where he faced the darkness and the horror, all the darkness and the horror that hell could throw at him. So Jesus is giving us these assurances in order that we may seek his solid joys and his lasting treasures. So as we close with our last hymn, I'd like us just to think about that. And I think it's important that Jesus calls us to him to be joyful. Not flippantly or stupidly joyful, but have real joy because of the reality of what he's achieved and the reality of our inheritance as a consequence of his gifts to us. Amen.